Greetings. I feel very happy to be here with all of you. This is the second time that I'm talking about the new book by Katagiri Roshi, our founder. The book is The Light That Shines Through Infinity, Zen and the Energy of Life. And today I'm talking about part one, which is called Life Force and Life. And this part covers an immense territory. It includes famous quotations from Shakyamuni Buddha, Dogen, Nagarjuna, the Blue Cliff Record, and a lot more than that too. So when I first started planning the talk, I thought, yikes, what was I thinking? Well, clearly not thinking about giving a talk, but here we are. So deciding what to talk about today reminded me a little bit about the whole process of deciding how to put the book together in the first place. I started working on the book 7 years ago, and I probably went through at least 25 attempts at coming up with the table of contents. In other words, how things would flow, how things would be put together. And working on this talk today was kind of the same way. So I looked at the big picture of the material, and I thought about how it has helped me to understand Zen philosophy and practice. And I came up with 3 points that are introduced in this part and then reappear throughout the book. So that's what I'm going to talk about. The first point I'm going to talk about is uniting the two aspects of my life. Next, practicing with the universe. Third, living as an energy intermediary. And then after that, I'm going to offer just some personal reflections on the significance of these in everyday life. I just want to review a little the background of the philosophy in this book, because it's really critical to understanding Katagiri Roshi's teaching. And I don't know that everybody heard kind of my introduction to this, so I think I'm just going to give you a little refresher. So the background philosophy is that we are looking at life, Buddhism is looking at life as a totality in which energy is constantly flowing through the universe, and things come into and go out of existence in a constant and very rapid process of moment-by-moment creation. Everything in the universe travels together through this process. And my understanding is that this is what we call the Buddha way. In this cosmology, Buddha is the original, undifferentiated energy of life itself. Dharma is that energy's creative phase, and Sangha is the embodied phase. When Buddha appears as all sentient beings or everything that exists in the universe. In this process, interdependent co-origination is the creative process that functions within the total process and is associated with Dharma. It begins at what Katagiri called the pivot of nothingness, or no-thingness. When the original undifferentiated energy of Buddha starts to move toward the embodied phase of Buddha. There are principles or rules guiding the process. Katagiri said it's not random. So sometimes the Dharma is called the law, but the vast matrix of interconnected causes and conditions that produce a moment of our life is too fast, too huge, and too flexible for us to intellectually comprehend it. Although there are times when we actually do see it happening, so we can kind of verify for ourselves that it's going on. Each of us is produced by this process, We exist for a moment, and then at the pivot of somethingness, that's my word. Kadagiri never said that. I added that. Our human form starts to dissolve, and it returns to the original formless space of emptiness. When the next moment begins, our life immediately reforms, but the causes and conditions creating that moment are different, so there is change. This energy cosmology can be found tucked away in a lot of Zen teaching. Once you know kind of what's going on, you'll start to see it in a lot of things that you read, and you go, aha, there it is. It's kind of like, where's Waldo, you know? If you look for it carefully, you can probably find it in there. Another thing that you'll probably see often, the way you can find it, it's a little out of order, but when you see the term birth and death, it's usually a shorthand. It's reminding you about this whole process that I just described. So here's the quote from Katagiri Roshi on today's program. The ordinary idea is that when you were born, the universe was already here. You were born into this world, and then you try to understand it. But if you try to understand in the ordinary way, you will never understand, because you were not born into a world that was already here. You and the whole world were born together. You were born simultaneously with mountains, rivers, and the whole universe. That is the Buddhist teaching of interdependent co-origination. I pretty much love this idea of being born together with everything. I'm an only child, and this is like getting lots of brothers and sisters. It feels nice to me. Okay, so now for the first of my 3 points, uniting the two aspects of our lives. Katagiri was always showing us that there are two aspects to our lives. On the surface of life, we temporarily exist as separate people with a body, a mind, and a self-centered point of view. This is our provisional self, or what he called our small self. But in the depth of life, we're interconnected with everything in the universe. That is our true self, or our big self. There are many other words in Buddhism to represent this play of two apparently opposite things, such as form and emptiness, relative and absolute, and individual and universal. In general, I think Zen practice is about uniting the two, either by bringing big self up into everyday life or letting go of small self and letting it drop down into emptiness. Without hearing about the depth of your life or having some direct experience or intuition of it yourself, you might not know it's there because of the way you come to exist. At the pivot of nothingness, the subtle vibration of the incipient moment creates a gap. That gap becomes the first link in a chain of causation that leads to your individual human life. That first link is called ignorance, or avijja in Sanskrit. The second link in the chain is the creative forces of karma, called samskara. Those forces accept the energy of that original ignorance and develop it into your human consciousness. From the surface of life, ignorance is usually seen as a delusion or a poison that causes suffering, but from the deeper point of view, it's a veil or curtain that's hiding your big self from your own view, leaving you aware only of the separate and vulnerable small self that needs protection if it's going to survive. So ignorance isn't originally your fault. It's already present in your life, leaving you yearning for something, seeking for whatever it is that seems to be missing in your life. I first thought about the downside of having a body when I watched a 1968 episode of Star Trek, where the Starship Enterprise gives a ride to the Medusan ambassador. Does anybody remember that? Medusans are a race of beings that have evolved into formlessness. They don't have bodies. The Medusan arrives in a box carried by an assistant who's blind. These are necessary precautions because if another race looks directly at the Medusan, that person will go crazy. One time, the lid of the box opens a little bit, and we can see that the Medusan's existence is green, sparkling energy. I love that. And lights. It's portrayed by lights, sparkling lights. Of course, a crisis develops that only the Medusan can resolve. But communication with the crew is needed, so the Medusan and Spock have a mind meld. Speaking from Spock's body, the Medusan says, "The aloneness! You are so alone. You live out your lives in this shell of flesh, self-contained, separate. How lonely you are! How terribly lonely!" Well, it's a great episode. It's perhaps worthy of its own talk. There's a lot in it that's really... when I look back on it now, you can get the script online, of course, and I read it again. There's a lot of material in it that I thought, ooh, here, look at that. There's little Buddhism tucked away in it all over the place. So the skin on our bones and the veil in our minds tell us one story. But when we study and practice then, we start seeing how our minds work and we start training our minds to see the bigger picture. Every time you stop and step aside from the thoughts and feelings of your small self, you create a space. And that space is where you can go deeper below the surface towards your big self. At the bottom of your life, the veil disappears and you experience yourself as you really originally are. My second point today is practicing with the universe. This one revolves around the meaning of the word practice. We know pretty well what our own practice is. But Katagiri says that our personal practice is part of a bigger practice. The whole dynamic universe is practicing. So we said at the start of every moment, the universe receives the energy of emptiness and changes it into the existence of things. At the end of the moment, all those beings give their energy back and go out of existence. There's a constant sequence of creation, destruction, and recreation. And you can see the same thing in Zazen. When you're mindful of your thoughts, you see that thoughts pop up out of nothing and then fade away back to nothing. And then more thoughts pop up. When you breathe in Zazen, on the inhale, you accept or receive air that is arising with you from emptiness, and on the exhale, you offer it or transmit it back to emptiness. There's always a kind of circulation of energy going on. And if you breathe wholeheartedly, with concentration, without self-consciousness, you can experience your own activity merging with the universe's activity. Then it seems the universe not you, is breathing. Kadagiri says, you join the flow of life, living in harmony with all beings. When it's experienced in sports or performance arts, that experience actually is called flow. When it shows up in zazen, it's called shikantaza, or just sitting. It's being aware of life, just lifing, without any effort from you. My third point is living as an energy intermediary. Kadagiri did not use the word intermediary. I'm borrowing it from Grace Shearson Roshi. About the flowing circulation of energy, she said, like pouring nectar between two cups, the absolute is poured into the relative, and the relative is poured into the absolute. You are the intermediary, receiving awareness and using it freely and flexibly. I really loved that. It's an important understanding in Zen that your life exists at the intersection of two worlds. It's expressed as form and emptiness, time and space, difference and equality, or light and darkness. Light lets you distinguish particular things and see their individuality, so it represents difference. Darkness represents sameness, because when you can't see and distinguish differences, everything becomes the same or equal. Seeing that each world contains the other is called having universal vision. This is how Kadagiri expresses it. He says, according to the teaching of impermanence, the world of light, phenomena, and distinction constantly flows into the world of darkness, truth, and equality. Darkness, truth, and equality constantly flow into light, distinction, and phenomena. So finally, you have to go beyond ideas of distinction and equality and see their interconnection. Then equality can be seen in distinction, and distinction can be seen in equality. Seeing in that way is seeing from the universal perspective. When you go deep into your own life and experience your equality with everything, the whole world is illuminated by your ability to see things as they really are. Kadagiri says this illuminating light is your great capacity to see things as they really are. One thing that I really love about this teaching is the way it corrects the common and mistaken idea that Buddhism devalues human life and material things because they're an illusion and don't really exist. Sure, we can explain that it means that things don't exist continuously because they're produced by impermanence and co-origination, but it sounds so dry and lifeless. While the idea that absolute truth is constantly flowing into me and all the things around me makes everyday life seem alive and magical. If you accept the idea that your own life exists in two worlds interconnected by the flow or circulation of cosmic energy, you can see that the ground or root of source of your own existence is the original Buddha energy. But you are that energy when it's manifested in individual form by Dharma. So right now, you are you, but you are also Buddha. The interesting thing is that, like the original Buddha energy, the Buddha that you are right now also has a creative phase. At the end of every moment, your life energy joins back up with the formless life, formless original energy of emptiness. but the energy you pour back into that original source is different from the energy you received from the original source. It's different because it's passed through your life. Katagiri sometimes used the word perfumed to hint at the wisp of change you bring to the whole system just by living one moment of your life. It means we influence and create the future by the way we live now. Katagiri really wanted people to understand that. I think it was one of the core principles of his teaching. He was always telling us how important and powerful we are and asking us to take good care of our lives. Well, that's what I wanted to say about the three points of uniting our two selves, practicing with the universe, and living and being an intermediary. So now I want to look at it a little more in the present day of my life and your life. Katagiri said, Buddhism is not a philosophical teaching. It's a teaching of human action. So if we think about right action in terms of these ideas, what do we come up with? In the first chapter, Katagiri says that whatever question or problem we have in life, it always comes down to asking ourselves, what shall I do? So how do we answer that question right now? How can this teaching help us? For one thing, I think it tells us that deciding what to do comes from seeing ourselves in two different ways. From the perspective of our small self, and also the perspective of our large self, our big self. And then acting in a way that's responsible to both parts, both selves. If we look at the practice aspect, it shows us to do our best and not get attached to getting a certain result from our actions, because there are always other influences in play. And we should constantly be letting go and enlarging our views, our point of view, and our understanding on what's actually happening or what should be happening, not getting stuck in any one position. If we look at being energy intermediaries, in terms of affecting change, we see that we're all agents of change, whether we think of ourselves that way or not. Everything we do makes a difference in some way, so we have to look honestly and carefully at our intentions and try to be broadly mindful of the ways our actions may help or harm ourselves or others, or have unintended consequences. I've personally been paying particular attention to the civic conversation happening now around keeping silent in the face of seeing or hearing things that we should not ignore or fail to contradict. I'm thinking about it because there have been many situations in my life where I have failed to say something that I later regret not having said, or I say things in an arrogant way that I also then resent having done and wished I hadn't said anything at all. So I've been working on right speech as a practice. I found an inspiring saying by a Buddhist ex-biker. Used to be in the Hells Angels, I believe. His name is James Veliskakis. It was something I read in Tricycle magazine. He said, take the time to talk from your depth. And that's what I'm trying to do. I often visit a family member who lives in a nursing home, and I get to know some of the other residents. One time we were in the dining area when one of the familiar residents started speaking quite loudly, saying derogatory things about black people in general. What should I do? Should I let it go because he had some form of dementia and nothing I could say was going to make a difference in his life or his thoughts? Should I keep quiet and avoid making a scene that would disturb the fragile residents who were in the dining area with us? But then I immediately thought, a lot of the people in this room, staff and residents, are black. And I really hate the idea that they're hearing this. So I did a quick gut check, and I found out that I was feeling very calm. And I also realized that I, as the white visitor coming in from the outside, was that I had an opportunity. In fact, I was probably the only person there who had an opportunity to say something. So I took a deep breath and I said, in a very pleasant kind of conversational way, I don't agree. And of course it didn't end there. He went on and on. He got louder and ruder. But for me, remarkably to myself, I felt completely calm. Eventually, someone called his wife on the phone and told him, you need to talk to your wife. That's how it ended. And later on, I saw him, he came back out after the meal and he started apologizing to all the black nurses. So I don't know if speaking up made a difference or not. That wasn't the point. It made a difference to me. It wasn't about getting a reward for, you know, being a good girl. I just felt relieved that I had recognized my responsibility to do something, that I'd spoken in a way that I didn't regret, and that, as far as I knew, I hadn't caused any harm. Since then, I've been a little braver in recognizing when it was my responsibility to say something and being willing to do it and doing it in a calm way. So I'm working on it. There are fast and unknowable causes and conditions contributing to every outcome, so we can never know what the consequences of our actions will really be. Sometimes we think we did something wrong, but it turns out to be a good thing, to have a good effect. And it works the other way too. But still, we have to try to get it right. In terms of change, the small things that I do are not necessarily more important than the big things that somebody else does. Sometimes the smallest actions end up making a huge difference beyond comprehension. The Taoist Book of Change, the I Ching, gives advice. It's an oracle. You can throw coins and get advice on what to do in a situation. It tells you what the big picture of the situation is, and it tells you whether the situation favors big actions, small actions, or no action. It's a matter of seeing the situation in the broadest possible way and understanding what actions will be truly beneficial. Right action is action done as practice. It applies to every kind of activity in every situation, from making lunch to watering your plants to practicing Zazen. So before you act, create a little space in your body and mind and invite energy to come up into that space. Let it come up into your everyday life. Then your action can be what Katagiri called swimming on the surface with your foot touching the ground. So I think I've taken this talk pretty far away from what you'll actually find if you read the book. This isn't the way Dogen taught about Buddhist philosophy and practice. But I hope that it will add some dimension to your reading if you do pick up the book. It's coming out in less than a couple of weeks, I think, from now. So thanks for listening to me. We've got time. I plan to keep it a little bit short, and it's a good thing because we didn't start on time either. So, but we do have time to talk. If you have any questions or comments, we have time to talk about them.
Yeah. Okay, so you said we can either bring the big self into the everyday or let the little self drop away into emptiness. Which is easier, and specifically, how do we do it?
Which is easier?
Or is there a difference?
Well, for me, it's a feeling. It's a feeling, you know, of what the situation you're in is. Which is easier? I think bringing it up into everyday life is easier. You're in a situation. You just pause and remind yourself about who you are, where you are, what's going on, that there's a bigger thing here, and that there's energy available to you, and bring it up. I think you can do that all the time. It's really doing things mindfully. It's being mindful that you're not just washing the dish, you're participating in something that's happening throughout the whole universe, and you're part of it. So you can just do that. You can light the candle. I remember seeing Katagiri just moving around. You seemed like he was always aware of bringing life to whatever situation he was in. Dropping down into emptiness. You can do that a little bit just before you bring it back up. You find it and you bring it back up. But to truly do it is a very difficult thing to do. It's a very rare thing to do, and can be a frightening thing to do. So you do have to prepare. You have to be ready for that if that's going to happen to you. Yeah?
I have a meta question. I think about the way that Katagiri Roshi prepared talks. So I've heard people say that he was hard to understand, but also he apparently, you know, to me it seems like he had a pretty expansive and precise vocabulary in English.
Yeah.
So if you could just talk a little bit about that, about how he prepared talks and used a dictionary.
He did. He used a dictionary. And that's one of the things that makes his language charming, because he didn't know the language. Well, I mean, it was his second language. It's really different from Japanese. English has a completely different structure of how it works. And he would use the dictionary to find words to use, but they weren't words that we would use necessarily in everyday life that were common and familiar to us. So sometimes you couldn't really, maybe it was the definition in the dictionary that was like the third or the fourth definition.
Right.
And so, He worked on translations with groups of people, and that was some of the seniors, not me. I wasn't one of those senior students at that time, but he would have gatherings or work one-on-one with people, and the students would help him figure out how to use our language to represent what he was trying to say, like how to translate his English to our English a little bit. Yeah. How he prepared his talks, he didn't prepare them like this, you know. He had an outline. So I've seen some of his outlines, and it would just be one piece of paper with some handwritten notations on it. But before that, he studied a lot. And there's a lot of notebooks here in the archives that show how he wrote down quotations he found in places, or he drew diagrams. There's lots of, I have one where it's got his handwriting on it. He drew a picture of a person sitting in Zazen, or a shape of Zazen. And the whole page is covered with notes, and, you know, this is this, and this is this, and, you know, and then there's other diagrams with triangles that go like that, and the bottom of the triangle is this, and I've studied those things over and over again, trying to get it, you know, how to put it all together into that little diagram. How do you put it together in a diagram of two intersecting triangles?
When you're working with the material and writing the book, you're actually listening to his old talks, right?
Most of them I listened to. Some of them were already transcribed, and I worked from transcriptions other people had done, which was interesting because sometimes I could, without hearing the tape, I could see places where people got it wrong. Because I could see what word really belonged there that they hadn't been able to hear. It was really hard to hear him, and you had to develop an ear for it, kind of. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah? Okay. Nothing? Yep.
You talked about, when you figure out how to handle a situation, taking care of both the bigger self and the smaller self. How do you take care of the smaller self without indulging in more delusion?
I think as long as we're just carrying on our day-to-day lives the way we are, we're kind of already in delusion. It's not something that we should really be escaping from. It's the reality of our lives right now. The way our eyes work, the way our brain works, we don't really see things the way they are. We're always filtering them. So we're not trying to get away from our delusions, we're just trying to fine-tune it a little bit. And I'm suggesting we do that by bringing more into our delusion, in a sense. To understand, for me, the thing I talked about, this gap where ignorance appears out of nothingness, it's there before we're born. There's nothing we can really do to get away from it. And the practice process of going back, you can work back through the steps that your life came into, but that's really serious Zen practice. It's not something that's going to just happen when you sit down on the cushion and say, oh, I think I'll go back to emptiness. You know, it's a long, arduous process to get there. So I just think we try to be wiser and more compassionate people as we are. Okay. I saw the light, you back there first. You?
I like when you gave your example of right speech or right action, because that's something I really wrestle with, kind of that awareness of, you know, I was kind of taught that philosophy of if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all.
Yeah, me
so
too.
A lot of time I spent silent. Yeah. Then I realized, I got to start speaking. But then sometimes I butcher it. And
yeah.
It's more harmful than helpful. Mm-hmm. But sometimes when you need to speak up, it doesn't feel nice necessarily because maybe it's really firm. And then maybe again, my perception of nice needs to be expanded. But
there's so much fear there, right?
Yeah.
There's fear of getting it wrong and fear of what the consequences will be of being ostracized or abandoned or disliked or all of those really deep, deep anxieties that we have come right up there. I know it really well.
Yeah, so it's very hard to act, yeah, because you're feeling the small self really react.
Right,
and then
right, and you feel like I have to protect myself.
Yeah.
And for me, the only thing is to accept that you will make mistakes and have a certain degree of trust in the universe to understand that you're working on it and that you're willing to learn from what you do and to take it into account or to grow yourself and your ability by actually trying to do it. And then letting it go and practice and letting it come back and yeah, it's real. I really know it, especially as women. We know this so well.
Thank you. That was very real.
Yeah. Charlie?
Yeah, kind of along those same lines. I noticed that if you don't say something, you play over and over in your mind what you should have said.
Yeah, I know. Too late. Oh, it's too late now.
If you say something wrong, you do the same thing. You play it over and over again. Right?
Yeah, but exactly.
I had an interesting occasion last night. We were at a banquet, and we're all sitting at the table, and my back is to the table behind me, and there's somebody talking on the stage. We're trying to hear it, and there's somebody at the other table. Is just they keep talking and keep talking like that. And I was the only one in the position to turn around and say something. I didn't want to do that. I figured I'd get it wrong. And finally, they wouldn't quiet down. I got up, turned around, and I just wanted to go like, and they weren't catching that. Finally, I thought I'd blame the rest of the table. I says, they're having trouble hearing it, says.
That was very tactful of you.
And that worked well.
Like in this example I gave about the nursing home, what really helped me was thinking about it from the big picture, and that's what you did. I mean, it's like you made it up, but in a sense you were. You know, there are people here who are being bothered by what's going on here, not just me, but a lot of people are bothered by this, and it should be corrected. You know, it's the right thing to do, but how are we going to do it? So you found a nice tactful way. I think you can do it by your tone of voice, you know, not blaming people, but just like assuming that they would like to be better people and giving them the information they need to be better and to cause less harm. So there's a certain, the antidote to the fear aspect of talking is to somehow find the idea that you're helping by, you know, you're doing something helpful, and to do it in a way that will be received helpfully. Yeah. To not separate yourself from people, but see yourself as working with people. Yeah, okay.
I just wanted to say that I was happy to hear you talk about having taking a breath or creating space.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of along the lines of what the conversation's been, I find that when I'm in a situation and something's happening and I get the knee-jerk emotional rise that comes, and that's not a place that you want to respond to someone.
Nope.
So having, instead of just being silent and just, you know, saying, well, I'm not going to respond skillfully, so, well, forget it, but taking that maybe a good breath and just creating that space and allowing something else to rise
Exactly, that's the key. It's the space allows something else to arise in you. Yeah, in you. And so it's such a relief. And we train our minds to do that by practicing Zazen. Your mind just gets used to it after a while. Just, you feel it, and you think, I can let it go and see what else is available to me. It's great, thank you.
And then your response will be something more helpful.
Right, because you bring up a sense of not separation, but somehow you bring back up that sense that you're connected and participating in something. And
thank you.
Hey, Val.
About 10 years ago, my son was going to college in Spain, and spring break adventure came around, and he was riding a train with a couple of his American friends through Germany. And I don't know what prompted it, but they were speaking loudly and with a lot of vulgarity, thinking they could get away with it in public. Mm. And a nice, mature German man said, "Boys, we speak your language. We know what you're saying. Mm. And this is the very thing that gives Americans a very bad name.
That's true.
In Europe. So we would appreciate it if you'd keep it to yourself in perfect English." And they were so humbled by it that he had the courage to tell me about it and the lesson he learned. Mm. So you never know who's listening. And you're right to be cautious, but of course, if this German man did it gracefully and tactfully and with maturity, and it changed the situation.
Yeah, that's the power.
Oh,
that we have. That's amazing. That's a good story, and I think we have, time has run out on us now.